Welcome to the History of Networking, where we drag all the skeletons out of the wiring closet and ponder the ghosts of protocols past.
Today, we are talking to Ken Duda about the history of backplanes.
So grab a pile of cookies, settle in, and listen as we meld with the finest minds in networking.
Hello, Donald.
Hey.
Back with the guitars today, I see. Yes, awesome. You know, we have Ken Duda with us, and today we are talking about, well, we say router backplanes, but we really mean just network device backplanes. When we're going to talk about the PICs, when we're going to talk about the MGS Plus, and no, Ken's over here shaking his head. No, no, we're not going to talk about the PICs. Or the entertaining 7200 with 2.5 PCI buses or whatever that thing was. So Ken, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Russ, thanks so much for having me on the show.
Yep, thanks for joining us. And I don't think you know Donald, but Donald's here with us. Donald's our usual co-host. Sometimes other people show up, but Donald's our usual co-host. And we're just here at the History of Networking. So Ken, speaking of History of Networking, why don't we start at the very beginning? You know, like, what was your favorite baby food? No. So how did you get into networking? How did you fall into this field that drives people crazy?
Yeah, well, I joined David Turretin's group at Stanford University, and David hooked up with a guy named Andy Bechtolsheim, who's one of the original Sun Microsystems founders, pretty well-known guy in the industry. And they had come to the conclusion that the industry, this was in 1995, that the industry had gone haywire. Over this thing called ATM. They thought ATM was the silliest thing they'd ever heard, and that all the world really needed was faster IP, faster Ethernet. And they decided to go prove that out by starting a company to build Ethernet switches. And I was in David Turretin's research group at the time, kind of a new student. I've been working pretty hard, so he tapped me and said, "Hey, Ken, you want to come and join?" So I joined up with them real early on at a company called Granite Systems, building some of the first single chip Ethernet switches. That's how I got my introduction to the field.
Oh, really cool. Yeah. So what year was this? So let's try to put this in context for listeners around like the SSE and the FPGA that was going on there and the first hardware-based switching stuff as opposed to the older software-based switching stuff that was going on.
Yeah, hardware switches are pretty much brand new. So there's a handful of startups doing this. There was Crescendo, got acquired by Cisco, Calpana, which got acquired by Cisco, and Grand Junction, got acquired by Cisco. It was ours, which got acquired by Cisco. And, I may be noticing a pattern here. And we are each had our own approach to constructing all hardware data paths. That was a new thing in the kind of the early 90s, was this idea that, hey, you could forward packets without touching them in software, even a single time, get the data path entirely in hardware. And the performance boost, both in terms of throughput, but also just in terms of like the predictable latency, because the hardware, you know, just pipeline just chugs away and pumps packets out. It was a real game changer for the way people build networks.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, because like I said, I remember Tony Lee did the SSE in the early 90s or something like that, and he used an FPGA just to prove that it was doable, basically, just to prove that hardware switching would make a difference. Mm-hmm. And at that time, you know, a lot of people didn't understand the difference there. And then we all went into hardware switching eventually, and everything became a switch. So, yeah, now we have layer 7 switches, layer 6 switches, layer 3 switches, layer 2 switches.
I have to ask, what's a layer 7 switch?
I just made that up, Donald.
Well, we talk about it. I mean, some device which is paying attention to the applications, right? Looking at the application, deciding what to do based on actually parsing HTTP requests and then routing the requests depending on the URL you're hitting, that sort of thing is what's going on there. And, yeah, people are trying to do that in hardware as well.
Wow. So let's begin with the very first. Let's go back to device backplanes or backplanes for forwarding devices. And, you know, in the beginning, maybe it's, I don't know how much of this is useful, but is it useful to ask what was the difference between a router and a switch in those days? I mean, going way back in those days.
In the 1990s, I think the assumption was, you know, a router was something that a telco could deploy to run the internet, basically. And a switch was something that maybe an enterprise could deploy in a workgroup context to interconnect a few workstations, some printers, you know, maybe a file server sitting somewhere. So the routers were doing big tables, lots of class of service stuff, quality of service, guaranteed bit rate stuff, all the security ACLs and advanced routing features, whereas the switches were pretty much looking at the MAC header and deciding which output port to go, and out it goes, you know, really basic. And what we've seen, of course, over the last 25 years is just a gradual, kind of relentless integration of more and more features into the switch silicon. And we're now at the point where you can build a carrier-grade router out of essentially off-the-shelf merchant silicon. So the boundary between switch and router is now really a marketing distinction, a software distinction. You know, it's maybe a form factor distinction of how many ports you've got or something, but it's no longer really a silicon or packet forwarding behavior distinction at this point in time.
Right. There was a time when the old joke at Cisco was, what's the difference between a router and a switch? And the answer was marketing.
Yeah, exactly. That's pretty much performance too, but
yeah, right. Exactly. So going back again to backplane. So let's talk about how these things connected to one another, the line cards, things like that to start with. And then let's work through some of the different mechanisms that have been used across the years and try to kind of maybe get to where we are today.
Yeah, exactly. So there's really been three major backplane architectures. The early switches worked on the principle of a shared bus. The idea was to run lots of serial links up and down. I shouldn't say serial links, I should say bus lanes. Lots of bus lanes up and down the backplane of the device. You basically had 200 to 500 signals that all were clocked in tandem, in lockstep. And so on a given bus cycle, you might have a start of packet, where if you looked at the bits on that backplane, what you'd see are kind of the parsed packet header fields. Like, here's the MAC source, here's the MAC destination, here's the VLAN that is in, here's something about what security groups might apply, here's something about class of service, and here's something about the egress ports, like which port of the device this thing's supposed to go out, that kind of metadata about the packet. And then on each of the subsequent clock cycles, there'd be a chunk of packet data on that backplane. So what's going on is, a packet comes into an ingress line card, it does some kind of a lookup, it decides which port the packet should go out, it takes control of the bus, then when it owns the bus, it can then put the header of the packet out, or the metadata out on the bus. The other line cards are listening to the bus, they see the metadata, they match against it, say, is that a VLAN I carry if it's a broadcast, or is that a port on my line card if it's a unicast? Then the packet data comes out, the egress line card captures the packet off the bus and then delivers the packet out to the end device. And it's a pretty straightforward design, made a lot of sense. As you can think about it kind of like the natural analog of like the good old, you know, think about inside a PC, right? You've got your ISA bus or your original PCI bus. It worked on the same principle. You've got these extension cards that kind of plug into this bus, and they take turns mastering the bus and driving address and data over that bus. It's really the same principles at work there.
So was the entire bus consumed by each packet? Is that essentially what's going on? Were there multiple lanes on the backplane that would allow a particular line card to receive more than one packet at a time or on different lanes? Or was it just like basically an Ethernet and everybody would stick everything onto the backplane and only one line card could talk at a time?
So in a single bus device, it's just one talker at a time. Okay. I wouldn't exactly call it Ethernet because, you know, it's just a very wide parallel thing. And so on the first clock, you got all this metadata, which isn't standardized anywhere. And then on the subsequent clocks, you get the packet data. And the packet data is the data in the Ethernet frame. So it's Ethernet in that sense that you've got a MAC destination, a MAC source, user type, and then data bytes, GRC. But it's missing the kind of Ethernet framing. So there's no start of packet delimiter, there's no preamble, there's no inter-packet gap. Those have all been removed by the MAC layer processing, the media access processing in the line cards themselves. So you're kind of left with the data of the Ethernet frame. I don't mean to quibble about whether it's Ethernet or not.
That's fine. Yeah, that's good. So then everybody hears it, but only one line card picks it up. Is that kind of what's going on?
Or unicast, right? So if it's a unicast frame, yeah, there's usually like an egress port identifier on the packet so that only the line card that has that packet will pick it up and the others just ignore the bus for the duration of that packet. But for a broadcast or for a multicast, then there's a different flag in that first, you know, chunk of data that all of the line cards will listen to the bus, each kind of pulling the copy off kind of in parallel, and then transmitting that copy as they're able to acquire the media. These are like some, this includes half duplex, right? So there can be collisions and all that other stuff going on at the level of the individual. And each line card kind of takes care of that independently. The bus is then used to distribute the broadcast among all the line cards that needs to egress.
So let's give some examples here so that people who are not familiar with this type of technology might know or remember. Maybe they don't even know these devices. I'm thinking Cat 5K, Cat 5000. Is that
The Cat 5000, I mean, broadly, was in this type of architecture. And actually, interestingly, to your point about is it one packet at a time, when Cisco did the Cat 5500, that's actually a three-bus device. It's the same bus structure as the Cat 5K, but there's three of them, so it has three times the throughput. And some line cards will be on just one device. Some line cards would attach to just one bus, but higher density line cards would attach to all three and could use any of the three or use the three in parallel to transmit packets.
So what about like the MGS Plus? Is that also running in this style of backplane, or is that something different?
I apologize, I'm not familiar with the.
Yeah, okay, that's fine. I'm just trying to give people a sense of like, you know, maybe devices they've heard of that might have done this. So if that's the first kind of backplane that we're talking about, which is kind of this a shared bus. Which, you know, AGS Plus, MGS, I think is a shared backplane, and the Cat 5K, I think is there anything after the Cat 5K that uses that, or the Cat 5500 that would use that? Anything in the modern world that uses that, or is that kind of a gone, people don't use that any longer?
On the high end, you know, this technology is completely obsolete. And I think on the low end, everything's single chip. So I would say that this is basically an end of life technology. The world, just like PCI has gone away, and now it's PCI Express, right?
Right.
Look at what the difference between PCI and PCI Express. You see with PCI Express, lots of serial links. There's these high-speed serial lanes that interconnect chips, and these serial lanes run independently of each other at the physical layer. Like, unlike a bus, where everything's clocked in lockstep, which really constrains the hardware design in a lot of ways. And can you look at some of the hardware impact of the backplane, the big parallel bus design, I think you see a lot of pain points. And one is that because all the lanes have to be clocked sort of synchronously, you're really constrained into your ability to like you can't have different things mastering different parts of the bus at the same time. You can't increase your throughput that way. All of your traces have to be the same length. You can't have you've got to need a very high quality, expensive material to carry all those links because you need the signal integrity issues. And then also, because all the line cards plug into this thing, it ends up kind of blocking airflow, right? So you wind up with this wall in between the front and the back of your device. You can't punch holes in that because that's where all your high-speed signals are going up and down that thing. And so you end up cooling these things side to side, which is like a disaster from a data center cooling architecture point of view, and also just from a efficiency of cooling. You know, you're cooling side to side. The first optics get the cool air, the optics at the end get the hot air. You know, cooling the optics at the end is a real problem. It's just a bad design. And so the serial link technology let us do was completely rethink the way the backplanes worked. And in fact, around the same time, the other big technological evolution was from multi-chip forwarding pipelines to single chip forwarding. So if you look at the modern silicon landscape, it's all single chip. Looking at the Tridents, the Tomahawks, looking at the DNX from Broadcom, you know, they're all single chip packages that do the whole job. They've got embedded memories and TCAMs, and they've got the packet parsers, the rewrite engines, all in one chip. And once you've got all of that processing in one chip, now you can do two things. First, you've got a much more cost-effective way to build a small-scale switch. It's just one chip. And that's actually a big part of why Granite was interesting as a company, was we made the first of these single-chip switches. But the other thing that is really great about it is now you can change the way the chassis architecture works, the way the backplane architecture works, because now instead of connecting one shared bus to everything, you can actually build a network inside the switch. The network is the switch. And so you end up with two layers of ASICs. there's ASICs on line cards that actually connect out to M systems. And there's also ASICs on so-called fabric cards, which provide kind of a spine. If you think about a leaf spine topology and like a data center cross right. network, mm-hmm. the same damn thing, just, you know, inside a box. And these designs are very cost effective. They use the same silicon as the single chip switches. And it has this amazing thing to the backplane, because what happens is you no longer need to run a lot of signals in parallel. What you need to do is get the signals through from the line card to the fabric card and back out to the line card again. And there's an amazingly clever thing that the industry came up with around, this was back in 2004, 2005, was this orthogonal midplane concept. The way this works is, instead of having just a big sheet in your backplane that has all these traces, everything's kind of plugged into, instead of that, you have like basically a checkerboard in the middle of your device. And the checkerboard alternates connector, hole, connector, hole, connector, hole, all the way up and down. And you plug the line cards in the front, and it mates in all the connectors along a row. And you plug the fabric cards in from the back, and they're vertical, and they occupy a column. And that's, picture your cross network and twist, and that's what you got. And the whole thing just works. You get every line card chip connected to every fabric card element through these connectors in the midplane.
So that sounds a lot like a butterfly topology in a large scale data center is what that sounds like. I don't know if you're familiar with that specific terminology, because a lot of people aren't, but it's a very specific kind of spine and leaf topology that has that kind of crossbar look from the top. I don't like calling them crossbars, because they're not really crossbars. I mean,
no, they're not crossbars. That's exactly right. The term that what I've heard used most commonly for the topology is a cross network.
Yeah.
They call it a CLO network, I guess.
Right.
So the idea here is that you've got an N-layer network where each element at one layer connects to all of the elements at the next layer up. I don't know if that's the same as a butterfly or not.
Yeah, butterfly is essentially a form of a BinA, which is a reconfigurable CLO network. Is they're all kind of in that same family of things.
The great thing about the CLO network structure is that if you've got some data you want to get from the edge, from one ingress edge to the egress edge, it can take any path. All the paths are completely symmetric, because you can get to anywhere from anywhere equally. So you can just take your packet and just pick any of the upstream elements, send it to that guy, and he'll bounce it down to the place where it's needed. So it's just a really uniform, simple topology, which, again, the largest data center operators have been deploying at the level of their whole network, but it also works really well inside a switch.
Inside of it. So what kind of control planes are used on these internal? Because, you know, normally you would use, like, I don't know, BGP, ISIS, OpenFabric, RIFT, something on an external fabric of that kind, like in a large-scale data center environment. What would you use internally? Because that's an interesting, I just never even thought of it. Like, how would you get packets across?
How does the software work? So the way the software works on these things, there's actually two approaches. One approach is that you put a CPU on every line card and a CPU on every fabric card, and you create some kind of distributed systems protocol inside the box. I think this is how SixPack works from Facebook. And the advantage of this is that you're using the same exact software that you're using on your 1U switches. The disadvantage of this is you've got like 12 times as many elements to manage, because you've got each line card and each fabric card winds up looking like its own element. Plus, I think the larger underappreciated problem is that you created a distributed systems challenge where you didn't need to do that. There's a world of, I don't know what your Unix background is, there's all this research in the 80s and 90s around trying to build these enormous computers, basically, or networks of computers that behave like a single Unix computer. It's like, but what it ends up doing is it creating this distributed systems problem where every system call becomes an exercise in like distributed consistency. And so the stuff never went anywhere. What actually won was just Linux, right? Containers, which are all run on a single node, and then something like Kubernetes, microservices, whatever, to kind of create a larger computation out of these centralized elements. And I think the same basic dynamic is at work here in these different architectures on the control plane, that if you create a distributed systems problem where you didn't need to, you're going to pay. You're going to pay in software complexity. You're going to pay in downtime. You're going to pay in convergence time. And so we've taken a different approach. I think that the commercial vendors, by and large, don't do that. They may or may not have CPUs on the line cards. There's actually a choice here. In our designs in Arista, we've avoided CPUs on the line cards and fabric cards completely. Saves cost, saves power, simplifies the software. And instead, we have supervisors with the software with a PCI Express network where every ASIC is a PCI Express box. And we actually had to modify Linux so we could address more than 256 PCI devices. I mean, it's PCI at kind of a scale beyond where most people run PCI. But what it lets us do is create a single system from the point of view of the software. It's just a lot of ASICs with a lot of ports. Now, there are things we've got to do to scale the software to support that, but the simplicity of having one system to manage, one system to debug, I think it's proven itself out.
So in that case, what you're doing is you're using the PCI bus as an out-of-band network, essentially, to reach all of the ASICs. Is that
That's exactly right. It's a switched PCI Express network inside the box to reach the ASICs and to load all the forwarding tables into them and to pull all the status out and collect the inbound packets and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, all that works over PCI Express.
Yeah, I remember the 7200 used PCI buses for its forwarding backplane, which was an interesting design. I guess just because the chipsets were simple. Now, would that fall, that would, I guess, fall into, because this was before PCI Express, would fall into a bus-style architecture, right? They were just using PCI.
Exactly right. They're using the PCI bus as the bus to interconnect the forwarding elements. That's exactly what they're doing. This sounds like a very Catalyst 5500 kind of design.
Yeah.
It's around the same time frame, right? There's a 7200 sort of.
Right, yeah. The old system, yeah, right about the same time frame. Right, exactly. So yeah, interesting. So you mentioned there were three kinds. So there's this first kind, which is the bus, right? Which is what we're kind of all familiar with from the old days, where the people who were around that long ago, like me.
Exactly.
and you and then there's this serial interface tile bus, which basically uses CLO networks internally. And there was a third that you mentioned. So what is the third one?
The third one is the fabric approach. And the fabric approach, it looks a lot like the second from the point of view of the physical arrangement of the components and the fact that they're connected via serial links. But here's where it becomes different. In the CLO network approach, if you look at what's going on a serial link, what do you see? An Ethernet packet comes into the box. The ingress chip picks a fabric element, sends the packet to the fabric element. It then sends the packet down and out it goes. Makes sense. The fabric approach changes that. And instead, here's the way it works. The packet comes into an ingress device. The ingress device performs a lookup and decides on the final egress port. It then enqueues the packet on a virtual output queue. Every ingress element has enough queues. So it's got a dedicated queue for every egress port across the whole box, not just the ones on that one chip. So if you've got a 700 port box, you've got 700 queues times 8 class of service levels, is like 5,600 queues. So you need quite a few queues on chip to do this. So now you've got all these queues on your ingress element pointing towards all the different egress ports. Then what you do is you send a control cell across this fabric. If the cell is from chip to chip, it's not really a packet. It's a fixed size cell, maybe 32 bytes, maybe 64 bytes. What you're doing is you're saying, hey, Mr. Egress element, I got a packet for you. And what the egress element does is schedules the available bandwidth and says, hey, I've got all these ingress ports that've got packets for me. I've only got 10 gigabits or 25 gigabits or whatever the output capacity. I'll allocate bandwidth, send them credits so that I'm sending credits at a rate that matches what I can deliver. So once the egress port is available, it sends credit back to the ingress. The ingress uses that credit to then dequeue the frame. Here's the cool thing. Slice it up into cells and just spray the cells across the fabric. What's so beautiful about this is no hotspots. In the CLO network design, you're typically flow hashing. To avoid reordering packets, you hash the flow, pick the egress link based on the hash. If it turns out that lots of packets going on a given port are all hitting the same fabric element, you end up building a queue in there. You've got to have buffer memory. You might get drops. It's like it's not really working like a big single chip switch. Like that's what you want, right? You want your multi-chip device to work like a single chip switch, just with made of lots of chips. But if you start losing packets in the middle, you're not really fulfilling that vision. The fabric-based architectures achieve that. They achieve sort of ideal forwarding in the sense that you never lose a packet in the fabric because you don't launch the packet into the fabric until there's bandwidth available at egress. And because it's completely balanced, you just take each packet and independently of where it's going, slice it and spray it. I sort of think of it like, you know, the Star Trek transporter for packets. It's like you're beaming the packet up, you know, and just turns all the little bits and they all fly through the fabric and they all come back down and get reassembled at the egress element where we already know the bandwidth is available.
So when did this start coming about? I remember something like this, I think, for the Cisco 12000 many, many years ago as being like one of the initial or original backplanes for the 12000 or the CRS-1, CSR-1, whichever. I never remember if it's SR or S, but anyway. Yeah, is it before that or is it after?
This is right around the same time. In fact, what I'm referring to is the earliest implementation that I saw was the Doom Networks implementation from around 2005.
Okay.
And that's what we end up using. They got acquired by Broadcom, and it's a Broadcom DNX line now, I guess. And so we use in the 7500 switches from Arista. And I believe those same chips are used in the CRS as well.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the same architecture.
Same architecture. And underneath that, is it a CLO or is it a toroid or is it a crossbar or how does that underlying fabric work? What's the underlying topology?
Well, it's the same topology in that every ingress element connects to every fabric element and every fabric element connects to all the egress elements.
Right. But then
so
you have this
same sort of folded CLO network kind of structure. But I don't think of it as a CLO network. When people say CLO network to me, what that conveys to me is that for any given flow of packets, I'm going to pick a path through that network, and all the packets are going to travel that path. And the fabrics are fundamentally different in that you want to know which path the packet took? It took all of them, you know? Like it's just a different way of thinking about it. But at the physical level, it is the same fundamental physical connectivity either way.
Okay. Because I seem to remember a toroid being used this way with the virtual output queues on top of it at some point, which was an interesting design because I think that was used in a couple of supercomputers way, way back, something like that. But yeah, interesting. So that was around 2005. So that's kind of where we are today, it sounds like, is we're kind of in the mode of having some chipsets or some devices that are pushing basically a CLO network with what is a moral equivalent of Ethernet framing. It may not be Ethernet framing, but it's the moral equivalent. And then we have this kind of atomization where we actually break the packets into cells, the cell kind of fabric structure that we're sending everything over, which kind of harkens back to ATM, right, a little bit.
Yes, there is certainly a similarity there. I think there's a big difference, though, in whether the cells escape the box or not.
Right.
Yeah. As a transport for within the box, I think that it's just gives you a really nice fabric behavior without complicating the end-to-end behavior of the network with a bunch of virtual circuits set up and all the other issues.
Now, historically, did that style of backplane, do you think it started with ATM? Because I remember the old Cisco 8500 had that, right? It was that kind of, you carried the cell, there was actually an ATM switch inside between the line cards, and you would carry everything as ATM. So is that kind of where it started, or was this something before that, or something along
those? No, because those are virtual circuit-based. The virtual circuits to carry the cell data. And the whole idea of the cell fabric is to get away from that and to instead just sort of the most aggressive form of equal cost multipath you can imagine, where every piece of your packet is being sprayed across this thing. So I think that it's actually a very different approach. I think that my sense of the 8500 was that was sort of opportunistic. They built a high speed chipset for ATM, realized the future was Ethernet, and then kind of figure out a way of using that chipset to deliver an Ethernet service. making the best of a challenging situation, I would say. Whereas the sort of DNX approach was much more purpose-built for the the transport of Ethernet threads. Yeah.
So interesting. So any interesting like stories along the way about how these backplanes came to be, or any side tracks that were taken that aren't around today beyond those three fundamental ones, that other than like the ATM style from the Cisco 8500, anything else that was out there that was interesting?
There's one other design which may be worth mentioning, which is that you don't necessarily have to put these sort of multi-chip architectures into a modular box. You can actually bake them onto a 1U box or a 2U box as well. So you get sort of smaller versions of these things where you can build like a little cross network of ASICs right there on your main switch card. So we've done, 6 or 9 or 12 of those guys on there. And we also did a toroid as well, and you mentioned the toroidal topology. For a smaller scale, that actually works really well. You take just 3 of these devices, connect each to its 2 neighbors, and then shortest path route that. So when a packet's coming in, if it's going to a port on the left, you go left. If it's a port on the right, you go right. Ends up working out real well as well for a sort of a bigger scale than a single chip, but you're not ready to bite off the cost of a full chassis trying to get that sort of in-between device scale. It's a pretty good approach also. So that's those architectures have been tried as well. I think so, to reasonably good effect. No other stories are coming to mind.
So I know we're talking about the past, but what's the future of, what's the next gen going to have in it?
Well, we're hard at work on 400 gig. We're shipping 400 gig just to start shipping here. And biggest data centers are consuming this stuff. We're seeing some real split between what's going on in the cloud scale operators versus kind of the rest of market. And the cloud scale operators continue to be the aggressive consumers of the highest speed links they can possibly get. And the rest of the market comes along based on evolution and take their time to adopt things, certainly. I think we're seeing a real split where the network vendors, the key to working and succeeding in the cloud is partnership. It's a kind of co-development. Because one way of looking at the cloud data center is they're building a data center. Another way of looking at it is, they're building a warehouse scale supercomputer that needs an interconnect. And I think that the latter conceptualization is actually the more interesting and useful one. And in that world, it's about figuring out how do you optimize for everything those guys are trying to optimize for at their scale. And of course, they are in the position to actually do this, and so we partner. If you look at the product we announced with Facebook, we basically co-designed and co-built a nice big modular switch with Facebook. They've built their own version. It runs EOS, it runs FBOSS, and that kind of partnership where one of the web operators came to me once and said, Ken, Arista is creating a real problem for me. I said, oh shoot, what's going wrong? Well, I've got a corporate mandate to be dual sourced. Buy from you. Who the hell is my other source? And so these guys literally decided to start building their own switches so that they could be dual sourced, like themselves and us as the two sources. And so this sort of tight partnership is what makes this possible. So at the high end, I think that's really what we're seeing. In terms of the backplane architectures, I mean, it's what we've already talked about. I'm not seeing a next generation of how to construct the midplane and how to physically lay this out, how to divide the functions between chips. I'm not seeing that changing very much. What we're seeing instead as the silicon scales up is we're seeing more and more cores within this ASICs, which enables them to sustain a higher packet forwarding rate, and then higher speed serial links that are enabled by the smaller feature size in the next generation of silicon technology, combined with then larger tables to fit more routing entries, more TCAM entries inside the chip. And then with that comes more programmability. So of course, Barefoot has made gotten a lot of attention for P4 and the programmability of the switch silicon. They're not the only ones, of course, whose chips are programmable to various extents. And that enables the network vendor to adapt the switch silicon's behavior to different use cases a lot more effectively. And this is enabled by the higher densities in the switch silicon. So that's the kind of evolution that I'm seeing, more at the device level, more than at the kind of backplane architecture. People like
Do you think that optical on-chip or anything like that is going to make a difference? Optical silicon photonics and stuff is going to make a difference in the way backplanes are running in the future? Do you think that's going to have any impact, or do you think that's too long out to look at, or what do you think is going on there?
Yeah, well, the onboard optics, of course, have been the holy grail for many years now, and it's just been really hard to get there. The packaging costs combined with the reliability of the optics themselves, since these things do have a non-trivial failure rate, and when they fail and they're pluggable, you plug in a new one. When they fail on the chip, you're RMAing a whole line card or a whole device, so it's a little more painful. Plus, the configurability aspects, that there's these different wavelengths and different colors and different signal strengths and everything else, intensities, to go different distances and different types of fiber. It's been really challenging to come up with one size fits all there. So I'm not seeing any near-term change in that. I think that people who are interested in acquiring optics companies are probably interested in building transceivers and capturing some of the transceiver margin, probably more than actually taking optical inside the device, because the electrical signaling is just so much more cost-effective and gives you this sort of plug-and-play capability relative to the optics. That said, we are reaching the limits. So going a lot faster than 100 gig SerDes over ordinary materials looks very challenging. So when you want to go 400 gig or terabit on a single lane, my understanding of the device physics is that that's really going to be hard. That we're going to hit some, just like how Moore's law continues to march along, but not on clock speed. Clock speed, 10, 15 years ago, and it's just not going any faster, fundamentally, because you just can't get the speed of light delays inside the chip. You just can't clock it faster than that, or different parts of the chip are out of sync with each other. And I think there's similar fundamental limitations in getting bits over a serial link, where, once you're losing sort of, one sigma of your signal-to-noise ratio over a one-inch trace, you're in trouble with regard to running that any appreciable distance inside the chassis. So
right,
we'll have to go optical to get to a higher serial link speed. I think the question is going to be, where is the trade-off between having more serial links versus higher speed serial links?
Right.
I think for the next generation or two, we'll probably stick with electrical and just go to more serial links. But after that,
it's hard to tell, what's going to happen after that, sure. Well, I think that's pretty much all my questions, and that's a really good overview of the history of router backplanes or device backplanes, and we didn't even talk about the PICs. What's up with that?
Does anyone want to talk about it?
No, probably not. Those are mental scars we all don't want to go through again. So, Donald, you're at Me Not You Sharp. You don't blog still. As hard as I try, I still can't get you to blog.
I program.
You program instead. Ken, do you have a blog or a Twitter handle or anything where people can get in touch with you with questions about backplanes or architecture or whatever they want to talk about?
For a networking guy, I'm amazingly poorly connected. I mostly stay under my little rock. email is always a possibility.
Okay. I assume you're on LinkedIn. Yeah, people can find you on LinkedIn. Good. All right.
Thank you so much. This is so much fun.
Yep, thank you. And we'll try to bring you back on in the future to have another discussion about something else in the history of networking.
That's cool.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Take care, guys. Bye.